Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And we're joined by Detavio Samuels, president of I1 Digital, a man of Duke. So go Duke in the house.
All right, I'm out.
Blue Devils all day.
I'm out.
Lord.
It's going to be that kind of show.
Wait,
already.
Was it undergrad or business school?
Undergrad.
Yeah. All right.
Can I make it better or worse?
Well, worse. You know what? It's okay. I just had this nightmare that you had also gone to Howard, and I was gonna have to have like a twofer.
My
whole office went to Howard, though. I'm tired of Howard people too.
See, the tide is turned.
Welcome back to the family.
Yeah, Howard can be a lot, but it's only because it's amazing and it's deserved. So it's not our fault.
Actually, you know where "Welcome Back to the Family" comes from? I'm gonna say this factoid because it's super random, but it's hilarious. There's a comedy from the 80s. I don't even think it's like a movie. It's like just strung together sketches, and it's called like A History of White People by Martin Short. And it's kind of like, it's like basically like Mr. White, except more extended and not a black dude pretending to be white. It's just white dudes. And there's this scene where it's the dude who plays the announcer in Best in Show, who's hilarious.
Okay.
I forget his name, but, you know, he's really funny. And his daughter, he thinks his daughter got pregnant from his, like, her boyfriend, right? And they go through this whole long thing where, like, they find out that the kid's been, like, having sex with his daughter, like, in their bed and all this stuff. And he loved the kid before he did this, right? And now he wants to, like, kill him. But then it turns out that the daughter, it was like a false positive. The daughter isn't pregnant, but they still found out all this other shit. And he just looks at the kid and he's like, "Welcome back to the family, son." Like, it's all gone out of his mind that the kid, like, fucked his daughter on his bed.
Once I heard it's all just this a pregnancy, funny scene. I was like, how's this going to involve Howard?
Yeah. Well, it involves Howard by me welcoming
back to the
him
yeah,
back to
I
the
get
family.
Yeah, I get it now, but at first I was like, huh?
Did
you sneak into our dorms?
Well, maybe if you went to Bates, you would have been faster on the draw with that.
Oh, come
Ooh,
on. Come on.
That's what I'm saying.
Stop.
That
we
is
don't
where
believe
I
you. We need more people.
Ugh. And very Howard to have the tired Jay-Z quote thrown
like
in
there's
as
such
well.
A thing. We're not even going to go down there. We're going to stop it right there because we're not going to get it. We're not going to devolve this into a Jay-Z conversation. But
that's exactly well put.
Ooh. My man is sitting with us, and this is going to be a little bit of a replay for me and you because we just did this last week at Communion. Shout out to everybody who came to Communion last week and joined a great conversation around media, black millennials, and specifically through the lens of what I1 Digital is building. So give us a overlay of your role in I1 Digital. What do you guys do? What are some of the key brands? You've been doing a ton. I don't want to spoil it, so you tell everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So I1 Digital is a part of Urban One. Urban One used to be called Radio One, founded by the legendary Kathy Hughes, who is still the chairwoman of Urban One, and run by her son, Alfred Liggins, who's the CEO. So inside of Urban One, there's five divisions. There's TV One, which is a television station. There's Radio One, 55 radio stations in 16 markets, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, R&B, hip hop, et cetera. Then there's Reach Media, which is the nationally syndicated radio piece. That's Tom Joyner, Ricky Smiley, Russ Parr, pretty much everybody who is a black syndicated host except for Steve Harvey and The Breakfast Club. And then there's I1 Digital. I1 Digital is now seven brands. So we recently launched a new site called Cassius, which is the new baby, also slated to be our master brand and kind of umbrella brand for the portfolio. But you also have phenomenal brands that represent the best of black culture, such as Bossup, Hello Beautiful, Madame Noir, News One, Global Grind, Hip Hop Wired. I'm hoping I named all seven. So I didn't miss any of them. And then the last division that we have is called One Solution, One Solution and One X. That's essentially kind of our internal agency and our branded content studio, which is also my other baby. So right now I'm responsible for One Solution, One X and I1 Digital. I1 Digital is just in the space of transformation. When I took over the brand, we had four brands: Hello Beautiful, News One, The Urban Daily, and Global Grind. And again, we've just been moving the needle and trying to position ourselves as what we are, which is just the best of Black culture in the digital space, the premier distributor of content for Black culture enthusiasts, essentially.
Now, what's really interesting is that you guys have had both an internal strategy, meaning building a brand, something like Cash is what you call like your sort of umbrella brand. And then you've also been an acquirer. So you've taken over properties like Abasa, a Madame Noir that come from outside of your previous core business. Like, how do you talk a little bit about the Cash's, the building of an internal brand, and then a little bit of that acquisition strategy as well, and how you're going to combine everything together?
Yeah, so I'm super happy that we did both. I think both are required. What the acquired brands bring us, Bossip, Hip Hop Wire, and Madame Noir, is scale. They also bring us strong brands and brands that are strong in certain spaces that we weren't strong in before. It's so hard in this digital game, which is a game of scale. Ultimately, we're trying to get to 50 million people, and you can't just do that by trying to grow your organic traffic or launching a new brand. So super happy and super proud of the brands that we've acquired and what they bring to the table. Launching Cash's was about, you know, when you look into the marketplace, most brands have some sort of an umbrella brand. So if you look at Vice, they have Broadly, which is for women, Munchies, which is for food, Noisy, which is for music, and, you know, 10 other brands. If you look at Complex, they have Pigeons and Planes, First We Feast, a couple of sneaker sites, but Complex is the master brand. And so we've typically gone to market with the iOne Digital, which is the trade brand, which consumers don't know. And then when consumers don't know it, then clients aren't as excited about it. So one of the things we knew we had to do coming into this year was really launch that umbrella brand, put a bunch of resources behind it so that consumers would know it, and even more importantly, the people, the advertisers that need to buy us needed to know it. So anyways, that's what we've been doing this year. To be honest, while I'm super happy about the portfolio we've built, if I could do it again, I would have done them at different times. So launching Cash's in the same quarter as acquiring three amazing brands has just put tremendous weight on the organization. But ultimately, I'm now looking at, you know, if you look at the top 10 brands that represent Black culture, I would argue we have 7 of them. And so I just believe we pulled together a portfolio that's better than anything on the marketplace.
How did you get where you are? What's your story?
All right. I mean, how far back you want me to go?
I want to go.
Not even the Duke days,
I want
right?
to know how. we'll skip the Duke days. Okay, right. So how did your dad first approach your mom?
Okay.
No, you could take it more recently.
Yeah. So the quick story of it, you know, I'll try to be quick, and you just let me know where you want to go.
Also like thematically, like, yeah, how did culture become your space? You know, how does it fit? I think anybody that works in these worlds, you know, there's usually an interesting story behind it and a lot of passion and conviction. I mean, I know you a little bit too before this. It's clear, it's evident, so just kind of let people in on it.
Yeah, no doubt. So for me, I think the story always starts second semester senior year at Duke. So as a young man, I was always pretty decent at school and pretty decent without putting much work into it. Second semester senior year, I take my first marketing course. Literally in undergrad, I didn't buy books. So I don't know how I got my grades. I don't know what happened. I just figured it out.
I didn't buy books either, my friends.
It's just a way to save money. I'd rather spend it on something else.
Yeah. Yes.
Second semester
and that's
senior
something
year.
Something else is weird.
Second semester senior year, I take my first marketing course, and for the first time, I want to buy the books. I want to understand the ins and outs. It was the first time that I really felt kind of set on fire by something in the school environment. So now it wasn't just about doing good. I actually really wanted to know the knowledge. And then connected that to, well, what's the job that these marketers go and do? And it was like, oh, I want to be a CMO at a Fortune 500 company. So I now have identified that at 21. And when I look at it, the only people who are hiring at these brands they're only hiring MBAs, right? So I decided at 21, I need to go get my MBA. The average age is 28, and I don't want to wait till 28. And so I ended up taking a job at Duke's Business School, you're like that, because I could sit in on the classes and start learning early, nice. And then also figure out how to get to business school early. Right. So long story short, I apply to business school. I get accepted to several schools. End up going to Stanford for my MBA.
In your face. I'm just playing.
Still part of the conversation.
I just played. I don't care. Fuck Stanford too.
So I leave Stanford and I go to global marketing at Johnson & Johnson. Right, right. And ultimately what happens when I'm finally in this brand position that I've been wanting is I really felt like my job was just to be a good filter. So there were these agency people who would come in with five cool ideas. My job was to tweak the ideas, kill two, tweak three, pass it on to the CEO for approval to see which one he chose. I didn't want to be on the filter side. I wanted to be on the idea side. So I ultimately ended up leaving at Johnson & Johnson, and I went to Global Hue, which at the time was the number one multicultural advertising agency in the space. So they were doing African-American, Hispanic, and Asian. No one else had all of that under one roof. Had a great run at Global Hue. Don Coleman, who was the CEO, was phenomenal. Great mentors, Alan Pugh, can't mention all the names. Long story short, I wake up after 6 years and I'm tired of creating ads. At this point in time, people are starting to find ways to ignore advertising,
What year is this? They start skipping.
Let's see. I'm probably a little bit bored in 2011, 2012.
Okay.
And then my real big issue was we kept going in front of these brands who had real problems to fix, but they were mad at us because the advertising wasn't great. And my point is the advertising will never be great until you actually fix your business, right?
So you are great.
Exactly, right? Right. So stop paying me to create another 30-second lie, right? Fix your business, and then that's going to be great. Anyways, what ends up happening is I become president at Global Hue. I take over the Chrysler business. On the opposite side of Chrysler is the CMO named Olivier Francois, who was probably one of the most amazing people I've had for me on the other side of the table. And it's there that he was just open to so many ideas. And so I get really introduced to the world of branded entertainment. We do a mini movie with Lenny Kravitz. This is before Beats by Dre was big. We put Beats by Dre and we put them in Chrysler vehicles. We then worked with Interscope, Sony, a bunch of music labels to put the cars in music videos, right? So now I'm producing branded content and I found kind of a new passion. So that's what leads me to the media side, right? I decide the next step is to jump over to the media side and work with the people who are just dope at creating content every single day. And so was recruited by Radio 1 to come over there and start One Solution. I told them I would only come if I could build a branded content studio. They said, okay. And so came over to the media side. So now I feel like I'm blessed in that I've been on the client side, the advertising agency side, and the media side. And my goal is figuring out how to pull the knowledge and the way that these different people approach their business all into one space. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I've been doing for the last few years.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, having had those experiences, are you finding that people are willing to now listen to all of your sort of knowledge and experience? Because we talk a lot about de-siloing and breaking people out of their one particular way of looking at things. And as you walk through your career path, it sounds like you've had these different opportunities to take from different pieces of the business, but now you're trying to build something that's more cohesive. Do people get that? Are they understanding that? Or are you still doing a little bit of education as to why that's how it should be?
Yeah, so my answer is there's a lot of education that's involved. So a few of the things that I feel like I'm up against. While I feel like the lines are absolutely blurring, and I actually believe, and this is why I came to media, I believe media is the new creative frontier. I feel like the lines are absolutely blurring, but I think that for me, where I've built an agency inside of a media company, people have a really hard time understanding, are you agency or are you media company, right? And our reality is we're flexible, right? We can be both, we can package it together. I think I have the most flexible business model out there, but I think that because people are so used to the silos, it's really hard for them to digest and understand all of them being under one roof. The other challenge that I have is I think just being on the media side, one of the biggest reasons why I dislike the media side is that media people don't usually have great access to clients. So when you're on the agency side, every day you only talk to the client. You know their business inside and out. You know their strategy. If you didn't write it, you help them come up with it. You know what they're doing. On the media side, we get RFP 10, 15 times a week for businesses that we've never talked to the clients on. So even the knowledge that I feel like we can bring to the table, we don't have access because there's a media agency in front of us. You know, all of those things, they RFP 50 people, put 20 ideas in front of a client and come back and tell you whether you made the cut or not, right? So anyways, I think the media side is too far removed from clients to be able to advise their business. And then the other thing is our platform is largely based on Black culture. Which means there's a huge focus on black people. And I've always felt and still believe that unless you're the mainstream and representing general market, you don't have the ear of the client. African-American, Latino companies don't have the ear of the client like the general market agencies do. And so, you know, I definitely feel siloed being black focused. I definitely feel siloed being media focused. And so we just hope that the answers lie in the solutions. But I really do wish there was more of an opportunity to be thought leaders for a lot of these brands. I think my team has the capability. You know, I think I've been blessed to have a unique experience. I just think we're limited right now based on space.
Too much distance.
Yeah. Do you think that there's some because one of the things that we talk about so much is this notion that, you know, that kind of culture is pushed and moves from the margins. And you see that everywhere. Okay. You always know that, like, if you want to anticipate what's going to happen in any way, and by the way, not just good things, terrible, ugly things, beautiful things, you got to go to the margins. If you wanted to look at, you know, I mean, part of the rise of this crisis we're in right now in terms of our culture and our politics, you would have to look at, you know, conversations that we're having inside video game forums in 2014, and people go, why the fuck do you care what these people are saying? Well, because they're going to help, you know, set a presidential election. So from that perspective, and you talk about the limitations that, you know, this notion of a general market versus a Latino or an African-American market, black market, that, you know, in some ways rubs against us the wrong way because we're interested in these kind of value communities and value coalitions that exist within demographics, but also outside them and transcend them. And then at the same time, it's like that blockage is still happening where first, okay, you're operating in the media space such as it is today, not such as people would want it to be because it fits their old business models. And secondly, you're in spaces where you already know, just from a mercenary perspective, if you're hanging out in these so-called, you know, cultural spaces, right, you're anticipating the future. That's already been kind of endlessly demonstrated. So what gives?
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, I think that brands are so focused on scale and numbers and reach. And so they fail to see sometimes the opportunity that exists on the edges. They fail to see the opportunity that exists with the people who are truly influencing culture. I tell that story all the time and I show the data. I'm like, black people may be 15% of this country, but 75% of whites and 67% of Hispanics see blacks as influencing mainstream culture. So you have to understand that you're not wasting money on the 15%, that if you do a very smart buy, you're leveraging the 15% to drive the other 85%. But again, I think that brands are just focused on impressions and reach and numbers and scale. And so we end up missing out on all those opportunities. But I tell my team all the time, nothing ever gets made from the mushy middle. And so I don't ever want to be in that space. I always want to be the people who are on the edges driving culture. I always want to be on the forefront of what's coming versus in the mushy middle or the gray where people are having conversations that's really not going to move the needle.
And there are no sidelines today either. Like, you have to have an opinion and you have to have a position on, you know, and that's in line with who you are. Do you think that there are, I'm trying to think of like a way to balance this because it's so ludicrous to think that you can measure cultural output just through impressions and through these kind of data-driven models. And we criticize that all the time. And then you look at, like, there's a lot of models out there that we could take from sociology or philosophy or cultural studies or biology even that try to kind of integrate these things. Like Ken Wilber's, this dude has this quadrant model that, like, on the right side of the quadrant is objective systems and there's culture and individual. And then on the left is culture and individual subjective systems. So there's, like, you know, on the right side, for broad groups of people, there's objective systems about, like, the way we, you know, control currency flows or how certain policies are designed. But then on the left is a whole cultural story and mythology about, you know, what capitalism is or what socialism is and what, you know, what success is, right? So I think of something like that quadrant model or, you know, something along those lines where it's taking question. It's not reducing the cultural question to objective quantifiable variables, because that's ridiculous. We need to fight against that. But maybe it's putting a little bit more heft to all of the, by definition, more amorphous, challenging areas that we deal with if we're working in cultural space. And if we start kind of sliding those parameters around it, or the frameworks that Phil and I work with, or the frameworks that you've developed, we could start to maybe start to position the conversation on our terms so that people can get it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, some of the frameworks that we may use are like diffusion theory or the adoption curve, that clearly states there are the cultural creators, right? The creators of currency. That's where I believe Black people, many minorities, whatever, lived. Then there are the early adopters, which I think, you know, any data will show you that, again, people of color tend to over-index in that space. Then it moves from the cultural creators to the early adopters to the masses and then to the laggards, right? So again, science has told us, or social science has told us, that this is a typical normal model. And if you want to move ideas, if you want to move culture, then this is the way that you need to play. But it's really about educating brands and finding those people like Olivier Francois on the other side of the table who are willing to take that risk, or who naturally get it, or who instinctively get it because they believe that it can move their business.
I want to talk specifically about caches, because I think when you guys are talking about the margin conversation, and then when you talked about not wanting to be in the middle, and we wrote a piece that Michael referenced by the wording, there are no sidelines, that, you know, you have to make a decision as to where you want to be.
Right.
You have to have a position. And you said you don't want to be in the mushy middle. When Caches was launched, I remember like seeing like the press releases and just the content as it was rolling out. And there was, I don't want to say double down, because that makes it seem like something that's not positive, but there was a lot of conversation about like being unapologetically Black, you know, and having come through like the multicultural space myself, I feel like a lot of players, or some players in that business, they try to have a toe in the space, but package things in a way that's going to be largely comfortable to the mainstream. You know what I mean?
100%.
And it seemed like right out the gate, there was not going to be that brand position. And so I'm curious about, was that a conscious decision with the team? Like, how did it come out to stake that claim while still providing content that you guys know is going to push that other 85%?
Yep. So a very conscious decision. While you'll hear me talk a lot about, you know, my job out here is to get brands and advertisers to pay us money so that I can help feed the families that do all of this great work. The first thing we knew we had to do, and we're still trying to do, is find audience, right? So you got to get it right with consumers first and foremost. If you don't get it right with them, you never scale to a point where the brands are going to want to pay for you. And my team kept coming back to me as we were saying, we're going to launch this new brand. What's the new space? What's the new lane? What's the white space? And they kept saying, it's tough. People have covered sneakers. People have covered automotive. People have covered fashion. All those things have been covered a million ways to one. What doesn't exist is someone who has this attitude of being completely unapologetic, of being willing to double down and say, this is our point of view and we're not scared of any single topic, and this is what we believe. And so, hence the name Caches, which perfectly captured everything that we want this brand to be, which is Caches Clay, aka Muhammad Ali, was representing the best of Black culture on a global stage, moving culture by being completely unapologetic. And so once we landed on that as the space, then it was kind of like, well, then you can't censor the team, right? The team may come with some crazy stuff or some crazy ideas, but if that's the brand idea that we're buying into, then that's what it's going to be. And then it was equally important for us not to dumb that down for brands, because what we didn't want to do was get a mismatch, right? We didn't want brands to come to us and then ask us to change. If the experiment we're running is about being unapologetic, and really the umbrella is about being unapologetically Black, is about being unapologetic. However, we censor Black culture, right? So unapologetically Black is a lane, but in general we just want to be unapologetic. Anyways, we didn't want brands to come to us to try to censor who the team was trying to be, specifically while we're trying to build audience. And so I'm great, and I appreciate the brands who showed up from the beginning, like a Coca-Cola, like a Cadillac, Lexus signed on. And
I thought the Jakob campaign you guys did for Lexus was impressive.
You like that?
No. I never thought the origin story of white people being grafted in a cave of making it a Lexus campaign. I was amazed.
Lexus is all getting ready to launch right now. So it doesn't exist anywhere on the site. But I appreciate those brands who stood up and said, we appreciate this. We see this positioning.
There are
and
no
we're
going
to back it from the start. Anyways, so much love to those brands who have been partners with Cassius from the beginning, regardless of the, because they believed in the position that we were taking.
And you talked about how all these different lanes have been done before in the sense of like there's automotive, there's fashion, there's sneakers, there's tons of other brands and platforms, media platforms that we could, content platforms rather, that we can name. And one of the easiest things for people to try to capture is this idea of what's cool. And that comes up a lot in conversations, no matter, like, everybody wants to capture this sort of amorphous characteristics of what's cool. And part of what you're doing is building a brand that's going to be considered cool. Like, what were the challenges of not duplicating what's out there, not just doing what might appear to be easy? Like, you're not making Hypebeast. You're not making something that's replicating those spaces.
Yeah. Building a brand that is quote unquote cool is probably the hardest thing to do, because one, you can't say you're cool and be cool, right?
I'm so fucking cool.
In fact, the people who say they're cool are the ones that people would say aren't cool, right? Cool is something that people see how you move, people see how you operate, and they acknowledge you as being cool. So it's really hard to build a cool brand. So a couple of steps that we took to be able to do that. One, fundamentally believe that it's about your taste profile. So unlike, you know, somebody like when you talk to someone who knows automotive, they know automotive inside and out. When you talk to someone who's done fashion, they know fashion inside out. Someone who knows cool or understands what's going to be cool, or to your earlier point, knows what's coming, right? Because right. You're so right. Far ahead of the curve. That's just like a
your
taste
cultural
profile.
Antenna.
Exactly, yeah. Right? So a lot of it was just hiring people who have the cultural antenna that we believe in, right? And that's just got to be a big piece of it, because it's not the data, it's not the science. It's, you know, again, we say it's a taste profile. I love the notion of like a cultural antenna. So it's about hiring people with the right cultural antenna. The other piece is trying to carve your space in the lanes that people see as cool. So that's why we're doing fashion and music and sports and culture more broadly, right? So let's tackle the right things with the people with the right cultural antenna, and then see if the experiment works. And again, you know, you're not ever going to hear us say that Cassius is a cool brand. It's not until the early adopters and the culture creators who have the same cultural antenna acknowledge us as being cool, then we'll know we did it right.
Maybe some lessons here for how to talk about, you know, Duke or Howard as an example. Just a thought.
They stand for themselves, my friend.
Exactly.
Well, there you go.
They do.
Decades exactly. of history.
So now, but don't let my pride interfere with their cool.
That's on you.
Those are two different conversations.
So, I mean, the last question I have before we wrap, I'm just curious about what when you're hiring, and hiring is a whole other area, all of the racial, sexual, age, but I want to add cognitive. I want to add, thought styles. I want to add life experience. I want people who didn't go to college. I want, people from real, true, and genuine, and deep and broad range. How do you hire and identify that instinct?
Yeah, I actually love the question. It's one of the things that I think we've gotten right for the most part. A big piece of it is hiring, and people say this all the time, they just never do it, but hiring people with diverse thought, right? Yep. So if I'm making a bet that you have the right cultural antenna across the board, how do I make sure that I'm bringing enough diverse point of views to the table? And so we've made sure we've hired Black, brown, white, blue, and purple. We've made sure we've hired male and female. The team is probably equally male and female right now. We've made sure we've hired LGBTQ and straight, right? It's all the people who can bring your antenna to this table from a diverse perspective so that we can then get in the room and then fight it all out, right? To figure out what is our point of view.
And then have
what
the cultural openness so that everybody can fight and argue and 100%. Push and pull and in a place of mutual respect and love, but also real genuine conflict and openness so the best can emerge.
That is literally the template right now, right? And so I think that we did a really good job on hiring a diverse team from start. I think that there's always going to be some gaps or some places where you think that you can add. But for us, it was culture antenna, diversity of thought, proven track record, and then you make your bets from there.
Beautiful. Well, that's on point.
Brother, it was great having you with us, man.
Oh, man, y'all kicking me off already?
Thanks for coming to the lab.
Let me just say Duke rocks, Stanford rocks. Just want to make sure everybody's clear before I get off.
You're going to cut that piece
out?
Okay, thank you. All right, appreciate it. Besides that, everything was great. That wasn't cool, dude. All right, we'll be back soon with more Dope Boys.